Hey guys, welcome to the Thunk Tank Podcast. If you're a new listener, we're basically three guys who like to drink craft beer and chat about interesting stuff. So for this episode, we decided to tackle the topic of the so-called intellectual dark web, or IDW. If you have already heard of this group and followed their work, then I think you'll probably find this episode enjoyable. And if you haven't heard of them, then maybe this can be a good introduction into what this group's about. I think it's a pretty important political and cultural movement for our country right now. Either way, bear with me for maybe a few minutes of intro here because I just want to frame the episode with a little bit of background. So generally, the state of politics is in a very dysfunctional and confused place, I think. I'm generally someone who's on the left of most issues, and since a young age, I've definitely called out or noticed the anti-intellectualism of the Republican Party or politics on the right more generally. But over the past few years, I've been tracking a different flavor of anti-intellectualism on the left. I consider myself a progressive, liberal left, but I want to draw a line of distinction between the more classically liberal stance on the left and what we can now call maybe the new left. That's what I've heard people using. The new left is where you will find an insistence on ideology above all else. The new left is where you can find concerning stances on, things like free speech and open dialogue. People don't really value the primacy of free speech on the new left. Well, they do for themselves, but not necessarily for people they disagree with. The new left is where online outrage mobs can go against all logic and incite and commit violence, on innocent people. The new left attacks its own even more, it seems, than people on the opposite side, the real racists or the real sexists. The new left is where you will see student protesters proudly waving the hammer and sickle flag, which is a symbol of the communist systems that brutally murdered hundreds of millions of people. You might be on the left and not even know what I'm talking about and not really have heard of some of these more extremes and militant aspects of the left. If that's the case, then I think probably this episode is even more important for you because it's the job of us on the left to clean up our own side and, push the extremes back out of the mainstream. It shouldn't be in the mainstream of acceptable dialogue to wave the hammer and sickle flag, for example. That experiment has been run. I will write a blog post to accompany this episode for more detail, and I'll link to, the countless events that showcase this troubling behavior on the left. If you've heard some of the names, these might sound familiar. I'm talking about cases such as Dean Spellman at Claremont McKenna University, or Charles Murray at Middlebury University, or Middlebury College, I think. Lindsay Shepherd in Canada, I'm forgetting the name of her university right now. The James Damore memo got a lot of attention in the media, but it's did anyone in that outrage mob actually read it or research James Damore? He's a soft-spoken autistic guy who was basically citing well-established science and pushing back some of the, against some of the new left ideology that has invaded corporate structures such as Google. He's the farthest thing from a sexist asshole that the media and the outrage mobs painted him to be. And then, of course, there's Brett Weinstein at Evergreen State College. This was one of the most extreme and yet also textbook examples of where this new left ideology can take us. There was essentially a Maoist type of takeover at a campus. If you listen to the things these people were saying, they were saying openly racist thing, offering food and water only to the students of color. They were basically wandering around campus with baseball bats searching for this so-called racist professor. You really have to look into the details of this one if you want to understand it, and it only gets more and more disturbing. This professor, Brett Weinstein, is a longtime Democrat who voted for Bernie Sanders. He's basically the opposite of the racist they painted him to be. But the new left has become known for eating its own very viciously, even more than its opponents. So hopefully you'll read the blog that goes along with this episode. If you're listening to this on the day it comes out, the blog might be slightly delayed by a few days, but in the episode notes, we'll put a lot of links and put the research that I did for this episode. So last thing is, how does the IDW fit into this? I think the IDW is basically a collection of individuals who are pushing back against this type of anti-intellectualism. They come from various backgrounds and political beliefs, but they share a foundation of intellectual honesty and healthy debate. They are probably more well known for their pushback against the New Left, but this is in large part because the New Left used its witch hunt mob-like, you know, outrage machine to try and smear these people. Everything from just calling them racist to like getting death threats sent their way. But they have also pushed back against anti-intellectualism on the right, of course. The founder of this movement is a brilliant mathematician named Eric Weinstein, and he defined the group as an alternative sense-making network. So in other words, politics and the mainstream media, it's all become so polarized and unreliable for intellectual honesty that people have grabbed onto this IDW content as an alternative network to try and understand the news events and the narratives that thread these events together. We rely on this stuff more than we think. So for me personally, in this polarized political time, the IDW and the thoughts and concepts that I've heard from the people in it have helped me find a more reasonable space to sit between the left and right. There has been so much smearing and spreading of disinformation about the people and the concept of the intellectual dark web. But the smearing fits right in with the intellectual dishonesty that the New Left is known for. And I think it's infecting the mainstream more and more as it gets into, organizations like the New York Times. I think we should be worried about it. So I think it's an important topic right now. Like most charged topics, though, it takes a lot of intellectual work to sort through all the bullshit and find a clear signal and something you can trust to know what's really going on. I tried to do that for many, many months, and it eventually led to me wanting to do this episode topic, and the other guys were happy to oblige my psychotic political manifesto-like writing from my previous blog post. We did an episode, episode number 16, I think, on political polarization. A lot of the same stuff. This is just going to focus more on how the intellectual dark web is trying to balance against that. So anyways, I hope this can encourage you to look into what people are saying and you know what the people in the IDW are saying and how it can maybe guide us out of our current political mess. I do believe that if the left does not clean up its act, then we'll probably have to deal with 4 more years of Trump or maybe even someone worse. I think the IDW is bringing a more reasonable voice to the left, and I hope that you'll, you know, consider doing your own balanced research and approach the topic with an open mind, skeptical but open mind. Also, the people in the IDW are way smarter and more articulate than us, so hopefully you just check them out directly. I'll put plenty of links in the episode notes and the blog post for that. Okay, 30 more seconds. Patreon. We do have a Patreon where you can support us if you like what we're doing. We reward our Patreon supporters with various things. The main thing is we do little drunk tank episodes where we'll crack open another beer after a full episode and we'll just kind of get silly and talk about whatever. Also, I think for this episode, because I did like a fair bit of research and it's filled with links and articles and ideas, so I'm going to put that Word document on Patreon as a reward as well. So if you're into this topic, you can, you know, click on all those links and kind of follow the research I did. This episode, when we recorded it, ended up being pretty long, I guess, like this intro. So I split it up into 2 parts. So this is part 1, and I kind of cut it out mid-conversation, and then part 2 will be following this in a few days. All right, yeah, so thanks for listening. We have fun making the podcast in general, and hopefully it's fun and useful to listen to. Please reach out, let us know what you think. As Joe likes to say, like, share, and subscribe. So either, you know, become a patron, that would be like the best way to support us, or leave a review or share the episode with, you know, someone who might like it. All right, that about does it. Here is the IDW.
Attention, humans. This is a Thunk Tank. Please insert this podcast directly into your nearest orifice for viewing pleasure.
Okay, you ready? Oh, shit.
Welcome to the Thunk Tank. Welcome to the Thunk Tank.
Oh yeah, there you go.
Welcome, come into our Thunk Tank.
Luke, don't switch to the other peanuts.
Welcome to the Thunk Tank. Come in the tank. We're thinking, and we're changing,
and we're thunked.
God, I'm probably more beer than man if we go far enough back at this point. It is like a clear anti-IDW. Yeah,
well,
because
well, we're going.
Okay. I was gonna say
The thoughts we were having were too good. I didn't want to waste them.
I was gonna say I don't know if people know really what it is yet enough to be against it.
I think
Luke, why don't you launch us off here?
I'll definitely
all aboard.
Push us away from the dock, but.
I'll definitely put a little intro attached to it, but I don't want to like make it a whole long thing. So I do have like a good definition for anybody who
your video's frozen
heard
too.
It before.
Oh yeah, the video is definitely frozen.
Well, you can hear us, right, Johnny?
Yeah.
Well, let's just keep.
We'll do it live.
Yeah, we'll do it live. So before I define it, I was just thinking something as I was writing down these notes. And maybe Joe or Johnny, you guys can both take your stab at answering it. So like our general podcast philosophy of just like, let's have a beer and chill. It seems on the surface to not mix very well with like, let's actually have a serious political discussion. But then I thought, no, it does. Like it's kind of exactly what is needed right now.
Yeah,
we
need more beer in politics. I agree. Yeah.
Well, actually, it's bad timing with the whole Kavanaugh thing.
I like beer.
Oh, too soon.
But I just mean like the idea of like having a beer and taking a breath and taking a step back and trying to
help in a lot of circles where you see people try to discuss something. And this is kind of what I feel like we're going to talk about, how a lot of it just devolves into yelling immediately. And it's like, well, if you can instead have a beer and sort of listen, you know, sit back and listen to what other people have to say, you might learn something. And in fact, you might come away with like a more enhanced perspective than you started with. Yay, wouldn't that be great for a change?
Oh my God, what a novel idea.
Revolutionary, right?
I think the base problem there is more societal and less political, though. It's like you've said, Joe, being a writing professor, is how many 18, 19-year-olds come to you and they haven't learned how to organize their thoughts in a coherent, expressive way to get their point across to another person. And it's like, yeah, of course they're not going to be able to handle a conversation with like complex like possibilities and hypotheticals that are moving and shifting. They can barely form their thoughts in sequence in a coherent way. So and that's why I think a lot of times you try to have discussions, even if you're both coming from like a good faith point of view, it's just, you can't, people, it breaks down and they start feeling overthinking. And then, you just get called a Nazi or hit with a brick or whatever.
whatever
is happening.
And once you're a Nazi, like might as well punch him, right? That's the idea, I guess.
You would have liked my class today, Luke, because what you're talking about, Johnny, that's exactly what we started discussing for their researched argument papers, where I basically spend the first class going into that about how, it's not enough to find one piece of evidence that agrees with what you've decided is already truth. And it's not enough to ignore the fact that there's alternative perspectives or counterarguments or other ways to think about any specific argument that you're going to try to present. Like, you have to address all of that. And that really is revolutionary for a lot of people. And it's kind of scary.
This is actually a concept that I want to go into later. Eric Weinstein, who is basically, let's say, the guy who tagged the name of the intellectual dark web.
Right.
He calls it camping and decamping. So let's say you're talking about flat earth. You say, okay, I'm going to camp as a flat earther. And I'm going to really genuinely learn everything that the flat earthers read and, watch the videos and then really pretend like I believe this.
Yeah, give it due
diligence.
Then
the key, though, is you have to decamp, go to the opposite perspective and say, let me look upon everything I know now with the skeptical eye of someone who's like, flat earth, that's fucking bullshit.
And you can use words like upon all of a sudden because you're much wiser.
But the ability of a mind to camp and decamp is kind of embedded in what this...
I like that, yeah.
By the way, we'll just say IDW. It means intellectual dark web. But let's just do 2 minutes of beer. I just wanted to stress the importance of beer for shit like this because, it's so easy to, get sucked into the rage aspect and then just, it becomes, fighting, political fighting.
You're right. I have a really good beer, and alcohol is a natural historical lubricant. You go back to, the Greek symposiums with Socrates and all that shit. Like, it was getting together and drinking wine that was watered down just enough to, really get the ideas flowing,
Yeah.
We're kind of, let's just say, start off the bat as arrogant as we can, that we're emulating Socrates.
We're essentially Greek philosophers, is what we're
essentially.
Yeah.
We're not Greek philosophers. Yeah, we're in league with the great ancient thinkers. But before we get into beer, I just want to say the reason I brought up the whole like people don't know how to argue. Like even when you tell that to somebody, they'll get angry and have an emotional response to that rather than saying, "Well, let's see if I can argue." So don't if we say something you don't like, just remember one of us might just be camping in that viewpoint for the other's sake. So don't think we're horrible, abhorrent people, or that we agree with you completely based on what you hear on this podcast.
Good point.
We're just trying to work through some ideas. So just keep that in mind. We're all pretty open-minded. I think classically liberal people, we'll get into what that means, but let's talk about beer. I just wanted to have that little disclaimer.
That's a good point. And like that we Johnny and Joe are both better than me at the playing the devil's advocate side.
I don't play.
I find it hard, like harder to do that, but I find I do it like when I'm by myself more than, you know, but I always use phrases like, oh, one might say X if they were arguing against me, but then I might reply Y. You know, that kind of back and forth that you can have inside your own mind means that as I forget the guy whose quote this is, but it's something like, you know, thoughts should be graceful. They shouldn't be like tied down. They should have a free floating gracefulness where you can play with them, that kind of idea.
Johnny, sounds like we got one of those round worlders here. I don't know.
That sounds like
all right, so what are you drinking, Johnny?
Yeah. I'm drinking a collab beer between Burial Beer Company down in Asheville and Finback.
Oh, good nice. Ones, yeah.
Which is Finback is I forget where.
Queens.
Yeah, it's
up by you guys somewhere. But it is a Black Sesame Imperial Stout. It's called In the Throes of Disembodiment. Sesame. It's got a crazy label, like a bunch of dead fish and stuff. And it's a Black Sesame Imperial Stout with vanilla, honey, and black sesame.
What is black sesame?
I think it's sesame seeds, right?
It's like a roasted sesame. Can you guys see my video or no?
Yeah. That's a cool picture, as usual.
Crazy
from
label.
Yeah, Burial has some solid label game.
And it's got that like, it's got like a chocolatey, almost like smoky. Hold on. Yeah, there's some like kind of undefinable thing about it.
Can you define it?
I don't know. It's kind of soy saucy. It's 11% alcohol. It's got that like umami taste that some big beers can get. And I think that's why they went with that sesame.
Sesame. Really interesting. Soy vibe really well. I always
The other beer I have that I'm going to open after this, I'll just introduce it now because we never get to talk about our second beers. We just start drinking them.
That's true. We should probably go through them in advance.
It's a Dunkelweiss, which is a German dark wheat beer style, but this is an American take on it. So it's an international Dunkelweiss or an IDW beer. So I specifically got this cast.
Boom.
So bam. So what are you guys drinking?
So Sand City, which is a brewery somewhat close by to us, recently had their third year anniversary, which is really cool because it's a very small brewery, very neighborhood. It's got like a good culture surrounding it, I'd say.
Fantastic brewery.
And also they went through a big struggle with the town that they're in, and they had to work through a lot of crazy things with lawyers and permits and, you know, closing down for time. So in honor of their third anniversary, we're having their first anniversary beer.
Yeah, we're doing it.
Because they released their first, second, and third anniversary beers all on this recent anniversary one. And I did not go. So I got whatever was left over, which was first anniversary.
And hey, it's not bad.
It's awesome.
Yeah, it's pretty good. It's pretty all right.
I had this beer a year ago at their second anniversary release party, which... You weren't there for, but that was a wild time.
Was that the one with the
keg exploded on my shirt?
I remember that story. That's a good one.
They had aged something in a barrel, and when they plucked open the barrel into it, it sprayed everywhere all over the crowd.
It's a classic mistake. I learned something beer-related when I was in Germany, and there's some town that does an Oktoberfest, and the mayor's job is to tap the giant barrel, is to like take the big wooden hammer and knock the tap in. And if he fucks it up, he's not eligible to run for mayor again next year.
Now, that's clearly
which is pretty awesome
to our political woes. I think you nailed it, Johnny.
Yeah, so it's like, I don't care if you're a man or a woman or like how you identify. Can you tap a keg? That's all we're...
Fair enough.
And run a city? Yeah. I thought that was cool.
There's your test right
there. That's a cool extra requirement.
Yeah.
My girlfriend was going to apply for some violin job, and it had in like parentheses on the bottom, must also be physically able to like lift heavy boxes and listed like physical labor things. Mm-hmm. It's like, wait a second. So
this isn't what
you're
I
saying.
It
you're going to give me like five students and then physical labor work the rest of the time, like just sneaking it in there.
Well, also jobs throw that in there just so that you can't say they're discriminating against you later for a disability.
Sure. Yeah. Yeah. No doubt. Like,
you know, like office jobs will be like able to bend like multiple times per day. And it's like, that's kind of weird. What am I doing in this office that you need
like
me to
probably
bend?
Lifting boxes.
Yeah. But yeah, also when they like, need you to lift a box, they don't want you to be like, eh,
not my job.
Wasn't on the form. I didn't sign up for that. Nope, it was on the form.
So what are you drinking, Joe? Same beer?
Yeah, we're splitting.
Yeah, we split them.
It's a classic.
Okay. All right, so...
We have some others, but...
And I brought a pumpkin beer just because it's the season.
This is probably the best
one. Oh, guys, we got to discuss. We have to do, like, something close to Halloween. We have to do, like, a spooky episode of some kind.
Oh, yeah. Let's do a spooky episode in the next... maybe when you come up here.
Another AI episode? Okay.
Yeah. We could do
light a candle and tell AI future stories.
We could do our AI ghosts or something like that. We could merge.
Maybe that would be a good sci-fi episode, though.
We could do sci-fi episode.
Just sci-fi in general.
Sci-fi in general, yeah.
It's pretty scary. We could focus on dystopias. Anyways, what's this whole IDW thing?
All right.
What does that mean?
IDW?
Is that an acronym for I don't what? What is it?
I don't what? All right. So I'll start with just explaining the name, because the name gets a lot of flack, and its purpose... The name is very much designed on purpose to sound kind of stupid.
I will say when I heard it for the first time, I was like, that doesn't sound great.
Right.
Which is kind of great.
So in general, it's a loose grouping of people.
So the Confederacy.
The intellectual dark web itself was...
Coming in hot.
A name that
Muddy
was introduced
waters,
on stage at a live podcast taping of a Sam Harris podcast by this guy, Eric Weinstein. Eric Weinstein is the brother of the somewhat more well-known Brett Weinstein. He was the professor at Evergreen State College who basically, that's a whole story. We might get into the details as part of the episode, but
it's pronounced Bowling Green.
Doesn't he run Peter Thiel's hedge fund though?
Yeah, he's the managing director of Thiel Capital, like the finances or something. Eric Weinstein.
Brett Weinstein. The guy's a billionaire, right? He runs. He's the guy a billionaire gave his money to manage. Just to give him some credentials.
He's a mathematician by training.
That's Eric?
Yeah.
Okay.
And Eric became part of this circle of going on podcasts, and he's very smart and talks about things in a very zoomed out way about the economy, about immigration, things like this. And so his brother is Brett, and that's kind of the connection. So he brought up this term just kind of, I guess he had thought about it beforehand, but it sounded like off the cuff on this live podcast. And then Sam Harris later titled that podcast The Intellectual Dark Web. This was January 2018. So we're about, as usual, 8 months late to hitting the breaking news.
But that's pretty good.
Of it.
Yeah, but that's still, in terms of... I don't know if I would yet call that an ideology, but whatever it is, that's pretty new.
Oh, it's new.
Yeah, eight months is nothing. Yeah,
it really wasn't popular, but then a few months later in May, a New York Times op-ed came out by this woman, Barry Weiss, and it was called The Intellectual Dark Web. The title may have been slightly different, but I'll link all these in the description.
I was going to say, what's
and
the
that
website?
Is what got it the mainstream media attention. Before that, it was just, you know... The fan base of Sam Harris and the like knew about it. Mm-hmm. But it wasn't so much talked about as like, oh, we are this distinct group of people, blah, blah, blah. But then it kind of took on this, what you might think at first, like, oh, it's a stupid name of like some grouping of people. Like, why do they have to be a group? But Eric later goes on to describe the purpose of the name, that it was obviously stupid and silly sounding. And it worked exactly as intended, in that the thesis of the name was that the news people, the commentariat of the mainstream media, were always going to dislike something that was trying to make sense of things that isn't the mainstream media.
So kind of like get ahead of that curve,
yes.
Almost in a way, yeah.
So the IDW, one of the best definitions I've heard is it's an alternative sense-making network. So when a news... something happens, you have to go, you can't just know facts, right? You have to get them from somewhere.
Yeah.
But you also have to get a narrative about those facts, right? You get a sort of, how does this fit into the arc of where we are, right? We didn't just get the facts about Kavanaugh. We got everything. It was embedded in the Me Too movement. It was, you know, like there was a lot of a narrative threading all the way up to that.
Well, I didn't see any news on it that was just like, here's what happened today in terms of actual just events.
Right.
In terms of a timeline. And that's funny you say that, because that you used to be able to do that, but I can't think of any mainstream media.
Well, you got to go to the
side of the political spectrum.
You got to go to the wire services for that.
Yeah, just get, like,
I still read Reuters all the time.
Yeah,
and they're like that's the wire service. They have reporters that get stories and then resell the stories for other. So like a Reuters story will be bought by CNN, and you can read the same articles, and you could see where they've just added in their take on it, and their. You know, but it's just it is funny to read those super like politicized stories and just their like breakdown, like lots of controversy as protesters arrived over heated this. Like, there's actually not much to cover when you read the wire service.
I love reading those. It's so refreshing after like the opposite, where it's just injected.
And if you read that first, you'd be like, yeah. Oh, what's going on? There's nothing. What's the problem?
Well, that's the thing. That hasn't been selling. I think that's why you see this with the mainstream media, where it is, I mean, it's increasingly more polarized, because it's like, well, when you can set up these camps and you can make people feel, you know, however they decide to feel based on what you're saying about a certain, you know, piece of news, and then they share it with their friends and they share it with their friends, and now it's all over Facebook. And guess what? You're getting clicks. Guess what? You can sell that information to advertisers, right?
Yeah,
did you see Ted Koppel was talking to some CNN guy, and he's making the point that Trump has been good for CNN. Their viewership's up like 30,
dude,
their, or their stock or something,
more
like
money.
They're up like 30%. And the guy arguing with him was like, no, it'll be fine. We don't care if it goes. Like, he just was so silly in his, like, no, like, we're doing this for, like, the, like, he had bought the whole honor of journalism. Like, this is our stand against, like, to save democracy bullshit. And it's like, yeah, but you're also a publicly traded company that's making bank on this right now. Like, your owners are pretty happy with it. But
right.
It was just funny to see him, like, try to, like, talk down Ted Koppel about it. Everyone just laughed at him. Mm. He's like, no, it definitely is good business for you guys.
I like to see it more as an emergent phenomenon. So I'm not as worried about organizations like the Huffington Post putting out, like, clickbaity, obviously bullshit
but
things.
They've always done that.
Calling Jordan Peterson a Nazi or whatever. You kind of know just by the layout of the website that you're not dealing with a legitimate, like, news organization.
Yeah, Breitbart's
anytime there's an ad that says secrets dermatologists don't want you to know, and I'm like, I think dermatologists want you to know all the secrets. They don't want people dying of skin cancer.
Right.
Like, that ad always bothered me, because it's implying that, like, dermatologists are just out to get you sick so that you have to come to them.
Wait, what ad?
Have you never seen those pop-up ads?
No,
it'd be like five anti-aging tips your dermatologist doesn't want you to know.
It's or funny.
Secrets that your nutritionist won't tell you.
It's
like, why would they be hiding info from you?
I showed, for, like I was saying earlier, how we started talking about research and, like, writing our research papers for my class today. And I started by showing them the John Oliver videos on research. There's one on research studies, but there's another one on what they call native advertising, and it's basically about sponsored content or paid content and how they're masked to look like actual types of journalism, and people don't realize, and they click on it, and it's like, oh yeah, this is, you know, I'm glad I know this now, like, oh, this is great, they have products that can help me. And it's like, well,
yeah.
No, they were either paid for it. I mean, if it's the most base level, it was paid by the companies themselves, or groups of these companies, basically. Like,
I forgot what they call it. They call it like sponsored content or something.
Or paid content,
paid content, but they don't actually call it not news, or, you know.
Well, the major news sites, they've been getting better at, like, having sections for it. Like, CNN has a section now that says paid content. I don't know if they used to. But CNN has such a clear narrative now, I think, to make up for that, because they make money on those paid content ads. So I think they've been able to say, like, oh, yeah, we can say that, like, we have our section for paid content, so people know that it's clearly not clear news.
We're not saying it's our un, you know.
Right. But then you read the rest of their news, and it's like, I'm like, wait, what? Like, what are you actually saying about this? That's just, you know, you're leaving out a lot of important.
And it's not a 100% problem, right? I've seen individual reporting on mainstream media that, like, cuts right through some of the bullshit. But the problem is, what is getting picked up in the general public? It's these grand narratives that settle into people's minds, not individual news stories, but narratives.
Well, and then people decide, like, well, that's what this type of news is. And that's why they go to it, because they figure, this is what the world is, and they're showing me the truth behind the world because it's what I agree with.
And they become comfortable with the style of how
exactly,
a certain thing gives
it to them. It doesn't challenge what is actually what you think is actually going on in the world. It just conforms to what you've decided is how the world works.
And even good old NPR is guilty of this.
I've seen it on NPR, too.
So I've seen it more and more on NPR as we move into the future.
The lean is getting...
Do
you guys ever watch the news and pull up the list of that network's advertisers while watching their like news roundup? It's interesting.
That's interesting.
Like,
I was watching
like a 20-minute coverage. I forget her name. I think Alex Wagner, that lady on MSNBC.
It sounds familiar.
But they were doing a thing about how Tesla, like Musk is out of his mind and irresponsible, and how Tesla is a failing company because it's never posted a like just bashing it and like. The recent fuck ups he did with the SEC fine and all that, but like they were just bashing it, like, you know, he's some playboy that doesn't know what he's doing trying to like run a car company. And I looked and I had their list of advertisers up because that's what I do. I'm a recovering conspiracy theorist, so I slipping in here and there.
Was like, relapsing.
Yeah, well, from time to time, like Ford Motor Company, I think GNC too, or GMC, General Motor Company, and it was like, oh, well, they spend a lot of money. They were like high up there on the list, and it's like, oh yeah, they definitely have a vested interest in like pushing down alternative cars. I'm sure that I could find like a really great expose on the Chevy Volt or something, you know. So it's just interesting to do that, but. The reason it's getting so bad is because there's so much money involved, and because like your boy Jordan Peterson has said, Luke, is it has to do with that was just a joke. It has to do with the time and the bandwidth, I think he calls it, which is you have 60 minutes, you have 20 minutes of advertising, you have 40 minutes to cover things without pissing off those advertisers and sometimes maybe even making them happy. So it's such a limited bandwidth, you can't really cover things or develop them as ideas. You really only have, you barely have time to put your slant on it, let alone try to steel man the opponent's argument and present your best argument.
Right, which all takes maybe hours. And all of the people in the intellectual dark web share that the content they're putting out is multiple hours long. And one of the coolest things is that people are tracking this stuff closely. We're not talking like a 10-15 minute, you know, long form interview on CNN. We're talking like a 3-hour podcast where people are hanging on to these people's every word, you know?
Yeah. And that's a huge difference because more and more when I see, because I'll see a podcast and I'll see somebody really interesting who I haven't heard speak before, and I'll watch it like a Joe Rogan interview, and it usually goes 2 or 3 hours.
He's in the IDW, by the way.
Checks out because I think, wow, I would never have gotten this type of insight in 100
and isn't
five
it so
minute interviews
thrilling
on
to
the
hear
news.
When you're used to a sort of sub, like there's like some kind of subterranean, like, people don't really say the truth. So when somebody comes out and starts saying the naked truth, it feels so good to hear.
It's superficial on these news interviews because they have to get sound bites. That's the type of questions they're asking.
Yeah.
That's why Rogan is good, even though he is a self-proclaimed moronic meathead, if you ask him. But he says what he wants to. Like, he doesn't, like, he got rich young and just does what he wants to do. So
he's got what he calls fuck you money.
Yeah. So when he realized that, he's like, no, I'm only going to do this podcast if I'm going to, like, so it's just, even if you disagree with him, like, he's genuine about it. You don't feel like someone, because that's the problem. Yeah. When someone's trying to sell you something, like, you could suspend your disbelief. Like, think about a salesman buying a car or something. You could convince yourself you got along with that guy. But if they break that fourth wall sometimes, you know, you get angry at him. It's annoying.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And you don't get that from him. So even when he disagrees with you or grates on you or says something that annoys you, like, you know, he's being, you know, he's genuine about it.
I would say genuine is a word that describes, I sort of listed the core members of the IDW. I'll list them in a second. Last thing I'll say about the name is that it was by design a Trojan horse strategy. So he kind of knew that the mainstream media, because this is sort of an alternative, let's say there you draw a straight line and you say this is the narrative arc of the mainstream media generally, right? And this is a very general zoomed out line of like what stories get reported on, which ones get pushed to be like really popular, that kind of stuff. So this is an alternative line. Sometimes it's parallel, sometimes it's not, right?
Right.
And so they were always going to hate it because it threatens their business model. And this is not necessarily even a conspiracy. This is just an emergent phenomenon when you're dealing with millions of people who are trying to individually make their careers work. as a business, make that business succeed, as a New York Times, sell more subscriptions, right? These kinds of things.
Yeah, it's like we talked about emergence. In our conspiracy episode where we talked about convergent interests.
Yeah, you don't need a grand designer. These things can emerge from many individual actors.
Yeah.
So it was a Trojan horse strategy because they were going to hate whatever name was attached to it. And so by making the name extra silly, people, the majority of the especially shallow attacking on it, because they looked at the list of names, they're like, oh, these guys are all like Nazi, alt-right, like, you know, you pick your attack on them. But they all made fun of the name, and that's what made it actually spread more popularly around mainstream media. Like, oh, who the fuck are these people with this stupid name, you know? And he purposely chose a name that was fragile like that because he wanted people to go, what the fuck is this? And then actually like, look into it.
It's not like an Antifa. You know, it's very easy. Like, they've all dismissed the name as silly, everyone that's been asked about
it. And like Rogan himself, he's like, I think it's kind of silly that we're in some group. It feels like a high school club and it feels really stupid.
So is there like an actual, how does this work? Is there an actual group with membership? Like, is there a website?
No,
like,
there was a website.
I think they get
down.
Together and
it's down.
I think they have a group chat and they like get dinner together now.
They did. I saw on somebody's Instagram. They had a dinner. It's a very loose collective.
That's what I mean. How do you get in? Like, is he like the lord of?
It's a loose collective.
The IDW.
It's a loose collective. Let me just read you the members.
You know how you get in, Joe? You get them to come on your podcast and you go on theirs.
Oh, let's get one of them on.
Yeah, I'm down.
Yeah, I'm sure they
would. You reach out.
I'll
be here.
I'm gonna write the email.
We're three fairly uneducated white males. They could help us, right? They might jump at that.
I mean, we're humans.
We're humans too.
They like that, right?
I've listed the people that I respect who are in this group and the ones that like are intelligent, thoughtful, and like these are compassionate people that are genuinely, like, let's say half of them are on the left Bernie Sanders voters, which is why it's hilarious that they get painted as like an alt-right group. It's a very mixed group from across the political spectrum. So we're talking Sam Harris, Joe Rogan, Eric Weinstein, Jordan Peterson, Brett Weinstein, Heather Haying, which is Brett Weinstein's wife. She's another amazing evolutionary biologist. Ben Shapiro, Douglas Murray, Majid Nawaz, Ayan Hirsi Ali, Christina Hoff Sommers, Dave Rubin, Michael Shermer. There's more, but that's just like the ones that initially came off my mind and who I read a lot of. These are all really smart people, and any of the attacks on the IDW in general rely on putting more abhorrent people into the group, like a Candace Owens or a Stephen Molyneux.
Are they actually in it?
Well, I mean, there is no in it. There is no like, you've now been inducted into the IDW. It's just a loose collective of nobody's in charge, right?
I thought they had dinner.
They did. None of them were at that, no.
Oh, okay.
The people at the dinner, I believe, were Rogan, Eric Weinstein, Jordan Peterson, Ben Shapiro, and that may have been it. It was a pretty small core group, let's say. Basically the people that live in L.A.
It was the L.A. Branch. Okay. So there's no website.
Like, I clicked on it today and it was down.
Well, I'm curious, like, if people...
you got to go to the dark web for that.
That's what I mean. Like, if people want to, like, learn more about it or, like...
I think the point of it isn't, like, they're a group of, like, pundits and talking heads and you got to hear their take or marching orders on it like you do on either side of the actual spectrum, you know?
Yeah.
How the pundits tend to just kind of fall in with whatever the party line is naturally, you know? It's just more that approach to it. Cause those guys like Ben Shapiro and, pretty much like most of the people in that group you listed are very different people.
Well, like Ben Shapiro,
like, very different views. He's
very
ultra conservative.
On the right.
He's on the right. Yeah.
And Sam Harris,
and he's like, he's a conservative
firmly on the left.
Right.
Yeah.
And
I think it's more about the
right now in this climate.
Yeah. It's more about that approach to intellectual pursuits that you're not getting from the mainstream media.
It's
they're
a
the dark web, the black market version.
A foundation of intellectual honesty,
God,
basically.
But to your earlier point, talk about threatening to the mainstream media business model. This is like everything that they
intellectual
don't want.
Intellectual honesty is
well, and
nowhere in the business model of
and
mainstream
and accomplishing
media.
That through long-form discourse.
Is also not.
That's not in the business model at all.
It's not making the money, and unfortunately, I don't think a lot of people can handle like the attention span of long form. Without podcasts, I don't think I would have hopped on board the long form like consumption. Yeah. Like I listen to podcasts in the car, and I drive around for a living. I teach music lessons, so I'm in the car a lot, you know?
Yeah.
And then I also go to the gym, and I'll put on like a Dave Rubin type show, which is a YouTube channel, and you can watch these interviews.
I was going to say so YouTube.
I get
is,
that time in.
YouTube is more and more where I get my news from because there are individual YouTubers who I listen. You're able to listen at length to what they're like, what information they're finding, how they're finding it, why they value it, and I say, yeah, that all checks out. That is not what you're getting from the mainstream media.
You know, I remember years ago when Google bought YouTube, and I was really disappointed because YouTube is very different. It's only like 12 years old, I think, or 15 years old. It's not that old of a company.
Yeah,
but I remember Google Video and YouTube being totally different. And YouTube, because it was like a small company, is like it was hard to get stuff content removed from it because they just didn't have like a team of lawyers, so it would take like months for a video to get taken down and then it would just get put up again the next day. So people, like, you know, it was good for the consumer even if it was something people didn't agree with. And then when Google bought it, I was like, oh man, they're going to corporatize it and all that, which they did, and they monetized it to some extent. But can you imagine if like Disney bought it or Viacom or one of the big media companies, they would have just turned it into literally a 24-hour stream of what goes on cable already. Yeah,
it's not perfect, but it's definitely
We're lucky Google bought it, even though they're turning to a big evil company.
I mean, Joe Rogan podcast is primarily.
I think he's regularly YouTube. In the top five podcasts in the country in terms of downloads.
Yeah, but like, but I mean, his podcast, like, do most of his listeners watch or listen on YouTube? Like, he doesn't have a site.
I would say most download.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But he
still gets 30,000 live viewers.
No, that's what I mean. Like, I've never downloaded
his. He gets hundreds of thousands and sometimes over a million views on YouTube.
Oh, on YouTube, yeah.
Because his podcasts are also put as full video with multiple camera angles on YouTube.
That's what I mean. I've never actually.
And live stream.
I've never actually, like, gone somewhere else and downloaded his podcast.
Oh,
like,
I mostly download them on Apple Podcasts.
Oh, see, I just watch on YouTube.
Like, share and subscribe.
And that's where I actually get most of my podcasts on YouTube.
Yeah,
YouTube,
you don't get the reads and the ads he does before the episode either. It just starts right with the podcast.
Oh, he does that? I didn't know he does that.
Oh, he does 10 minutes of ads before his other, but honestly, like,
but I don't have to pay for it.
This
on
is
YouTube.
One of the business model of his podcast that's really great is I often love listening to the ads because he's still just being himself, being silly, and often the products that he recommends
cool. Buy that, you dumb sack of shit.
Yeah.
Like that.
He's like, these are literally the most comfortable pair of underwears I ever had. Go to MeUndies.com and type in the code Rogan.
You're going to be happy you got these underpants. oh, see, now I got to get those underpants. I'm convinced. I'm sold, man.
So one last thing about like the definition / mission of the group. It's a loose collective. There's no set group. It's a concept. It has a purposely silly name, but it's a concept of alternative sense making. And Eric Weinstein put this in a very cool way that I just had to write down and say. The IDW is not fighting journalism generally. It's fighting what is largely considered journalism right now. It's totally for the concept of actual journalism where you go after the truth no matter what. But right now, that's not what most journalism is. So he says, the kind of journalism we have now is one where they clearly have their finger on the scale as they're reporting the weight, you know?
Yeah.
Well, it's the way, like, it's whoa, why is your finger on the scale? Like, let's just show us the reading as it is, not how you want it us to
I think
it.
In a lot of ways, like these big outlets, it's kind of for them a dying industry, or it's been a dying industry, and they're
desperate for survival.
Well, and they're desperate to do what they have to, and that's why you see, like, I mean, I think the right was just better at it for longer in terms of...
The right is mostly better at almost everything than the left.
Oh, I would agree.
At just doing it.
I would agree with that, and the left has been trying to catch up, I feel like they've been trying to catch up, and that's why today it's like there's no mainstream news outlet anymore that I listen to, because I'm like, again, individually you do find articles sometimes and I can sort of sift through, but you have to do so much work to make sure that what you're getting is what you're getting.
And it's intellectual weightlifting to just say, okay, do I take this at its word? Do I assume there's some amount of bias that has sneaked in?
Yeah.
Okay, I can smell they have their finger on the scale, but just how much, right?
Yeah.
And there's two ways to put your finger on the scale. You can take an individual story and report on it in a sketchy way, but the other way you can put your finger on the scale in terms of the longer narrative is you can say, okay, I'm going to be selective about which news stories I report on. And that's what even organizations like NPR and the New York Times have started doing. By selecting which stories you decide fit your narrative and are worthy of reporting, that means our version of reality that we're getting is skewed based on your design. That's fucked up. You should just be a neutral reporter of events. And if a really crazy event happens, for example, if a college in Washington State has a bunch of black racist people take over and tell whites they can't be on campus, and they take over the entire campus as a bunch of rioters with baseball bats, and the president tells like the cops to stand down, and they're wandering campus looking for a quote-unquote racist professor, you know, the kind that voted for Bernie Sanders. This doesn't make the New York Times for 3 weeks because they didn't know how to report on something that was black people being racist against white people. That didn't fit the narrative. Had a cop killed a black person, it would have been on the front page the next day. And so they did three news stories on it. And
who, the New York Times?
Yeah, two were op-eds. And then the...
What school?
The Evergreen controversy.
Oh, you didn't say what school, though.
Evergreen State College?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Just so everyone knows.
Yeah, I'll link to this. Maybe it'll come up again because that's probably the textbook version of what happens if this stuff goes out of hand in the most extreme way kind of thing.
You made kind of a signal with your hand.
A Heil Hitler signal?
Yeah, it was a little...
Well, you know, they do that in Christian churches.
Do they really?
Yeah. I was at a baptism the other day, and everybody went like this. I was like, oh, what's happening?
Yeah, that's not going to work.
I guess it's like something like putting your hand to God or something like that.
Well, I think going along this idea just briefly about like how things need to fit into a narrative, I think, too, what it comes down to is like things have to fit in the narrative because the narrative is the business model. And the business model at the end of the day, I think it really comes down to it's like they need clicks. They need to make money. And I saw this. What really outraged me was when Elon Musk a few weeks ago was on the Joe Rogan podcast, and all you saw everywhere was
the fact that Elon Musk took a tiny hit of a spliff.
And in fact, after he took the hit of the spliff, he said how like he doesn't like weed and how it doesn't do anything for him. So if anything, it was an anti-weed moment.
Did he do the classic politician? Oh, I didn't inhale.
No,
because he said he didn't.
Doesn't do anything for me. He's like, in fact, I don't really smoke it because I find it makes me unproductive.
Yeah,
and he's like, and that's not good when you're running companies. So if anything,
Elon Musk.
Yeah, if anything,
it was
an anti.
If he's doing any,
but like CNN, MSNBC, NPR, all the only articles they posted were these articles, picture of him hitting this joint saying, you know, essentially a CEO.
Well, because that's not that's not part of the narrative. CEOs aren't supposed to get high on weed publicly.
They saw that everybody else, I think they saw that everybody else was reporting on that and said, we got to get into this fray because this is clicks. And that's messed up because usually the leftist narrative of these news outlets is, hey, we need to decriminalize marijuana. It's, you know, it's really used as a tool to, you know, imprison like and segregate people and like throw
all right,
these
Kanye,
prisons.
Calm down. We'll get rid of your 13.
Oh yeah, you're doing a Kanye rant.
I'm going full Kanye. But you know what I mean? Like that's usually usually their narrative, right? And they were totally willing to break from that in order to just they were like, this is what's trending right now. We got to get in on this.
And it didn't break their
nonsense.
Larger narrative too much, right?
Exactly.
So they were able to do that.
It was able to slip in.
Yeah.
But somebody who has half a brain.
Also, he was white.
Well, that helps.
If they had been like picking on like a rich like CEO of multiple companies for taking one hit of weed and it was a black person, like they wouldn't go near that, right?
You might be onto something there. And again, I think you're really right when you say like it was just enough where they realized like, oh, this isn't going to harm the narrative that we normally like mold to.
Yeah.
And it's going to get clicks because they know anything with Elon and controversy, Elon Musk, they're going to get clicks on.
And again, this involves the majority of people in the media are not lying consciously. They're not thinking that they're doing this. They are an emergent phenomenon in these groups. But there is a minority of people that know that they're lying. They know they have their finger on the scale, and they know exactly how and why what they're doing is making them money.
Well, there's always people pulling, or there's groups of people who are primarily pulling the strings. And of course, there's other factors involved in that. But yeah, I think you're right. It's like there are people who at the end of the day, they know like, this is what we need to do. This is the model that
we
need
have
to
be careful with something like journalism. Like we use that to shape our model of reality. And if you start messing with how you build those, and I'm not talking like, again, about individual news stories so much. It's
I agree with that. Yeah.
A slight tilt over the course. Like, so I'm mostly talking the changes I see that led me to be so intellectually excited by the IDW we're talking from like 2013 onward, institutions like the New York Times, NPR, you started to see that like, whoa, this has always been towards the left, but facts always mattered above all else, but that doesn't seem to be the case. And you're seeing radical people get into these organizations, like the New York Times just hired Sarah Jiang. She's like this radical feminist that she deleted a bunch of tweets, but people got screenshots of it.
Oh,
like,
you can never delete those tweets. Never. Just they like, do not never. Go away.
I'd have to look up, but it's pretty awful shit just saying like, you know, fuck all white men. They're all like shit like this. Very popular in social justice warrior circles. And it's one thing for those circles to exist. That. Whatever. This is a free country. You can do and say what you want, you know, to the extent that you can. But for that person to be hired at the New York Times, that's troubling. That's a level of shitty reporting.
Well, it's
and
not
ideology.
Troubling. It's not troubling if she said something that she changed her mind on or was a joke or whatever, and it's something she deleted and doesn't stand by anymore.
Oh, but you
it's,
can't do it that. It was troubling. You get fired for that all the time.
Yeah,
dude.
What's troubling is if she doesn't get punished for it, and then like you take away like the movie, like Guardians of the Galaxy, from that director guy,
right?
Because he made some pedophile joke, and he's a white guy, so you know that's the argument why they took it away. It's not fair when you start seeing different treatment for different people. I mean, of course, those are separate cases, but. Yeah, that's the troubling thing is when you start having like castes and tiers
sure.
of people's status to things.
When you see this,
that's what's more troubling because I don't care if a writer wants to say publicly racist things against white people. Like, whatever. I really don't care. Are they a good? Isn't she a technology writer? Is she good at that? Like,
yeah, I don't think that. It's obvious that if her tweets were the opposite, right?
Right.
That nobody would go near her, and I understand that, but racism is racism. It doesn't matter in which direction it's going.
Oh, that's not true.
Well, it's not true based on some people's changing of definitions.
Right.
And we can
their argument, the argument there is your definition was ignorant of the socio, like historical, like economics, like landscape that has led to this point.
The intersectionality.
Yes, because of that, and because of the institutionalized...
Oh, he's pulling out the fancy words.
Because of institutionalized historical racism, you didn't even realize that you were wrong about racism this whole time. We just figured out what the real meaning is, which means it can't happen to you because you have power that you don't even know about.
Right.
So
we'll get
you've been
that.
Wrong this whole time.
I think there is something. There are grains of truth sprinkled throughout the concept of intersectionality, which we can define in a little bit, but for the most part, most of who I hear using it, I would just call bullshit on most of it. So last thing I'll say is the intellectual dark web is also extremely successful right now and getting so many downloads, so many views. It's just a really popular movement, and I think it's because people are starving for real intellectual, honest, like balanced thinking and reporting.
Yeah, on either side.
On either side, and the politics of the people in this group, they often disagree very, very, you know, extremely about, certainly about specific issues, but even about more general ideas. And the way that they talk through it is so healthy. For example, there was an amazing debate between Sam Harris and Jordan Peterson just talking about, you know, the philosophy of ethics and how we arrive at values from facts, like really interesting conversations. Jordan Peterson, somewhat religious. Sam Harris is an outspoken atheist, right? On the two nights, the second night, they each steel-manned each other's points from the previous night. It means, let me give the strongest account of what you were trying to say, and you do that for me, and then we build from there. It's such a healthy having of conversation, and it definitely awakens more sort of intellectual energy in myself. And last thing I'll say is Eric Weinstein was careful about saying we have to be careful that you know, we don't become, in our attempt to be so anti-tribal, that we don't become a tribe ourselves, right? But he also said that groups are important. So we have to be what he calls it adaptively tribal. And I have like a short 30-second clip of him talking about why the concept of the group existing is actually a good thing. Joe, you can watch on the screen if you want.
I don't think that we should talk about positive models of masculinity. Mm-hmm. And standing shoulder to shoulder with somebody in a fight is an important part of what it means to be complete in a masculine sense. And I think that we are all incentivized by shows, you know, like Survivor or, you know, the Last Contestant or whatever, all this stuff. And you know, they do the promos with the contestants on these shows. Like, I'm not here to make friends. I'm mm-hmm. here to win. You know? Okay, well, what is that? That's mm-hmm. corporate America teaching us how to stab everyone else in the back on your way to the top.
Well, which actually doesn't work very well, by the way.
It doesn't work at all, mm-hmm. right?
Or not for that long, I guess.
If you can't follow, you can't lead.
Mm-hmm. And if you can't make friends, well, then you're alone and vulnerable.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. You know, I mean, maybe Stalin is the best example of a really malignant person who managed to kill everybody, including, I think, his wife. Mm-hmm. But it's very rare that anybody, you know, does that. Really, what these things are, because you have to remember that fragging is a possibility. The lowest person in your organization can take you down if they're not happy.
Right, right.
Right? And so I think that what people need to understand is that there is this lost art of standing with somebody that you don't 100% agree with, who says things that are like, you know, there are definitely things you do on stage that I'm not comfortable with, but if somebody comes to attack you, fundamentally, I know that all of those points I can bring up to you, you know, face to face. I assume it's true in reverse. And so this idea of...
He goes on and on about that. He stood shoulder to shoulder with his brother when his brother was being painted as a, you know, the racist professor. And he went ahead and stood up for Jordan Peterson. Jordan Peterson was talking in a lecture about a concept called enforced monogamy, which is just a term that, if you didn't know the term, it sounds like a concept where, like, people at gunpoint are holding you and saying, like, you bang, go, bang monogamy. Only one person. Zip papers.
I don't like how you gave them an accent. That was kind of offensive.
It's not okay to give Russian accents.
He didn't even realize it, Johnny. That's the worst part.
Yeah.
So, and then, like, the New York Times reporter, like, purposely, like, misled their readership by saying, like, oh, he's for enforced monogamy. And then, so Eric Weinstein, in a very Eric Weinstein way, the way he came to the defense of Peterson was, he just did a backward search of every time the New York Times has used that term, and they've used it like 3, 4, 5 times, actually reporting on what it actually is in the field. And like he was just like, oh, so I guess the New York Times also should get on itself for such, you know, like, for, you know, because it's like you've used this very word. Like, you didn't even search your own archives to figure out what the word means when you're making an article about it.
But see, that doesn't outrage me as a New York Times reader.
Fair enough. I guess if outrage is your currency, right?
Well, I think it is for a lot of people.
But that's the whole, like, it's not okay. Like, the whole Thanksgiving table rules have kind of like edged into every part of society.
Right.
Like, you're not supposed to talk about politics or controversial
or
science
religion.
With people.
Yeah.
Yeah, politics is religion. Those are the two things. Like, we weren't allowed to talk about that at the table when I was little because our grandma disagreed with our parents and it would just lead to a fight. So no politics and no religion at the table. And it's like that's just extended to everything, including like, you know, television or whatever. Like, you just can't, like, to have an unpopular opinion, it's the bandwidth issue. You don't have the time to explain like what enforcement. It's not worth it. You're going to lose people explaining the full story. It's better to just hit them with that quick hit.
Well, I think too, part of it,
this motherfucker is telling you have to get married because of all those gross incels in their basements. Like, it's an easy thing to get people to feel about because it's what you're chasing.
Especially
over
when the target you're going after is somebody that, one, you have predetermined you want to try and take down, and two, many other people want to take that person down, so you know you'll have a readership, not only in a readership, but people who will spread the article and get more people to read it, post about it.
Yeah, that's the thing, too, why I think people, they aren't able to argue beyond that. They're not able to have an actual conversation about anything, because I think a lot of this is a failure to adapt to how we have access to information today. Not just how quickly, but how much, because anything you say to me, like if we were just hanging out at a bar somewhere talking and, you know, say like we were just acquaintances or something and you said something I fundamentally disagreed with, I can pretty much instantly find an entire volume, an entire library of bullshit that seemingly totally validates what I believe.
Yeah.
And I don't have to put in any actual intellectual rigor beyond that. And it's very easy to feel like, look at all this. I mean, this is what you see on a very superficial level with the people who legitimately believe in flat Earth theory, right?
Right.
It's these people who are able. There's so much bullshit out there masquerading as science and masquerading as actual.
And how
fact.
Do you tell the difference?
It's a great question, right?
You can,
but again, it takes work and
it's
time.
It's not
and
as easy as you think, though.
Well, that's the thing. It's much easier for a lot of people a lot of times to just say, "Wow, look at all this. This is clearly representative of reality, right? I'm able to search this in Google. Holy shit! There's like 1.8 million results.
Right?
It's got to be real.
Well,
it's got to be true.
Our brains evolved to deal with groups of people and truth claims from people on the scale of like a few hundred people tops, right?
That's a great point too. So 1.8 million suddenly looks like it's got to be real.
Yeah. I mean, I have no grasp of what's going on in a country really, other than the narrative I get from most media sources. Now, of course, there are...
You've never been to Azerbaijan?
A few times. Like, we used to do summer vacation there, but, you know.
Great place in the summer.
Beaches dried up.
Yeah.
Yeah, what a surprise.
It's a landlocked country, but go ahead.
Well, that checks out.
So one of the ideas, I also like the concept of a group, like calling it something even, is that individuals get picked off very easily. And you know what one of the most disturbing things I heard Brett Weinstein say after the whole shit went down at Evergreen? Again, I keep referencing Evergreen. You're going to have to just look it up if you haven't heard of it. But he had to leave there. It was a whole thing. But he said the amount of emails he privately got from professors there saying, look, I would totally... stand up for you because, like, I think this is all bullshit, but I just have to keep quiet. Like, I just had a baby. Like, I'm not going to get fired at this time in my life.
Oh, I can tell you that's definitely how it is.
So I don't think it's a problem in that, oh my God, 75% of professors have these anti-liberal views. I think it's that the minority is silencing the majority.
Yeah, no, there's definitely, I mean, there's things that you can say and can't say in academia.
And that's bullshit. Academia,
but you're right. People won't say it because they're afraid. It's like, I can't afford to lose my health insurance.
Yeah,
I can't afford to lose my pension.
What if you had a kid or two kids?
Fair enough.
And isn't it because academia is such a business now? Like,
oh, it's
there are more admins than teachers.
Any industry that has like $1 trillion in debt attached to it, which they do with student loan debt, that's a big business. Yeah. That's a big industry.
Any schools used to just be like, once you paid for the cost of the school, you just had to keep the educator alive, right? And they could live off not much because most of their work is done with like books and ideas. Like, wasn't that the whole idea for a long time?
Well, the pursuit of truth.
Yeah, like you're not going to get rich being a teacher, but like nobody should get rich. Teachers still don't get rich, but a lot of people get rich off of education. And it's like,
the people getting rich off education are fairly
not the teachers,
fairly rarely the teachers. Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of I mean, heck, if you know, academia is one thing, like college education is one thing, but I mean, certainly, you know, American grade school education is like, I mean, there are people like on the poverty line, you know, in education, and it's like, well, where is this money going to? It's like some of it just doesn't exist, but there's a lot.
How much
of money
is the average
in administration?
How much is the average college like credit at a private university cost?
A private university?
Yeah, one credit hour or whatever they count it as. How much is one credit in a three-credit class?
At a private university?
It's got to be hundreds of dollars.
Oh, it's probably closer to $1,000. It's probably like $1,000,
right.
I mean, it depends on the college. But
how many kids in that class? Even if you only have 30 kids, that's $3,000 an hour you're making.
Well,
you have
most
classes
three credits each.
But that's what I'm saying. Just on that one, like, there's a lot of money coming in.
Yeah.
And, like, I get that they have to spend it on research and things like that, but I feel like a lot of that goes to bullshit. But because there's so much coming in, there's that pressure on it. It's so weird, man. I can't imagine going to college.
I mean, we talked about this in our college episode.
You're beyond that.
About administrative bloating in general.
Yeah.
And,
well, it's funny.
If you create more positions, they create. So, in other words,
it's like you said with the media, it's now it's a system, it's a business.
It self sustains.
And it has to do what it has to do.
And it won't
survive.
Die quietly.
It's not going to die quietly, and it's going to do what it needs to do to survive and to continue
and
to
it will
grow.
Find inequality on campus. It will find needs to do equity proposals, all things that sound good, but when you look into them, and this is what Brett Weinstein did on his campus, there was the Evergreen like equity proposal, I forget the exact name, but it was something like that, and he read into it, and besides it being a really troubling document that basically made no sense, it was like, yeah, I want to sign up for what's on the outside of the box, but can I look inside?
Yeah.
And he said he bet that he him and his wife may have been one of a very few people who actually read the entire like 50-page document. He said it was almost made to be impossibly difficult to try and read and get through.
Yeah.
Like sentence structure and everything. And it was filled with so many grammatical mistakes and just like typo mistakes. Yeah. He's like, did anybody read this? Is this just like a...
Well, this is the problem too, is that, I mean, there are issues that should be addressed. I mean, there are issues on college campus. I mean, the fact that, you know, it's like you look at certain college campuses and you look at like sexual abuse rates or sexual assault rates, and it's like, all right, that's an issue on a lot of campuses and it should be addressed. But if that becomes part of a business model now,
or
and
if
you're able
to
expand
exactly.
that business model and you're able to then say, well, let's bring in all this, you know,
other expensive stuff that gets us more money
and now,
gets me an assistant.
And now we, you know? Yeah, and now we have it. So we have to support it and expand it. Now, what are you
what
doing?
What if you solve the problem? Do you get rid of your department? Do you gracefully resign and retire your position because you've done your work? No, you're going to create more and more of a problem and paint a picture, just like the media paints a picture that crime is up, right? Violent crime is down 50%, but the reporting of it is like up 50%, you know?
Where you get that stat from?
I mean, I don't know the reporting statistic, but I know it's over the past 50 years, it's gone down like by half.
Yeah.
Violent crime.
I think that's true with like
but the reporting of it has gone up.
Kidnappings too. It's like
it's true with all things. Yeah. Like negative things have gone down because the world is getting better and better. But if you watch the media, you would think the world is getting worse and worse. It's a negativity bias. They're not going to report, oh, like in New York today, nothing happened. It was a lovely afternoon in Central Park. But if somebody like took out a samurai sword and started chopping off heads, like they're going to report that.
Wait, did that happen?
No, but now you're going to think it. Like
yeah,
when
no,
you're
I was
in
about,
Central
I was,
Park next time, you're going
to
think twice.
I was about to click on what you were saying right there. That was good. That was actually pretty good. But I think, so is any amount of that though, the fact that like, okay, being aware of like, if we're more aware of it, is that necessarily a bad thing, though? Because it's still happening, right?
Like, it's not a bad thing if you can have the more complex view, which is understanding statistics and understanding that
right.
it's better, but
yeah.
I'm seeing more of it. Like, but
right.
but that's more than most people just turn on the news as a side part
yeah.
of their day.
Yeah, I think you're right. I think it takes a higher level of intellectual...
Higher rigor, resolution model.
Yeah, rigor to then say, all right, well, why is it still happening the way it is? Like, is it that we've decreased it in this amount of way and we need to continue to do what we're doing to continue to make things better? Is something else happening now that we need to address? But I think you're right. Like, you don't see that type of conversation happening, right?
And this is a good question. One, yeah, you do in these IDW circles.
Right, that's kind
but
of
but not in the mainstream.
Yeah, that's why it's kind of fulfilling.
But here's a good question.
Need,
I
right?
actually heard this recently because you would say, okay, all the stats about racism, sexism, they're all getting better and better, but they're not perfect, right? Now,
yeah.
that's another example. You would think with the whole Me Too movement and all this stuff that sexism has gotten worse, that racism has gotten worse. It's not. That's not the case. Those things have all gotten better, but they're not totally gone, right? So, for example, you could zoom out and ask a question. What amount of suffering in the world is allowable? Is it, you know, like, do we have to just strive until we get to zero? Is there an amount of corrective force to fixing suffering that will cause more suffering than what exists? In other words...
The law of diminishing returns?
Exactly. So what amount
yeah.
of tampering do you want to do to a system to make it more fair before you risk destroying the whole system?
Yeah,
that's just a thought experiment.
We could replace all the sharp edges with Nerf, but then, like, you know, camping would be a lot less fun.
Right.
The Nerf industry.
Like, going on a hike would be a lot less interesting.
No more,
like,
knives. Starting in 2030, knives aren't being...
Yeah,
sold,
like...
Well,
like,
people
you could,
can't stab
you,
each other if there's no knives.
Yeah, but you also can't, like... You have
that's
to eat
sentence.
Your vegetables whole and raw now. Or whole and cooked.
No, like all grocery stores will have
anymore.
Chopped vegetables now.
You know, it's funny. I was
yeah, that's what I'm saying. It'd get real weird real quick.
I was thinking about that too with like the peanut allergy thing, because that was like that's been. I mean, it's kind of been on and off, like sort of an issue. And like I've heard like controversies where it's like, oh, they've banned peanut butter now in this school. But like that's such a prevalent issue now with allergies, where it's like, well, what if you now ban... People are just as allergic to other tree nuts, so what if you ban those? And what if... You know, at what point is it like, well, I'm a vegetarian, like, I don't eat, like that's what I eat is like that type of stuff.
Meat makes me nauseous. Just the
that's
smell
what I mean.
Of
so
it.
Like, at what point is it kind of like
also the
where do you
certain
draw the
words?
Line there,
certain
right?
words you say make me feel unsafe. So I'm going to call that violence, and then I'm going to require the school make a safe space. Well, that school will put teddy bears in there, and it will make me feel comfortable because a university is a home, and it should feel like I'm with my mommy getting cuddled.
Wait, where are their teddy bears?
There were.
Where can I get?
I forget who was giving a speech, but one of the safe spaces that a fucking university made for their students involved a room where they didn't have to listen to this person's speech and a bunch of teddy bears to make them feel extra safe.
I mean, that's fine. I've seen schools where they have like animal support dogs, like for
that's cool,
kids get stressed
though.
Out
dogs.
In the library, like or during finals, they'll just have like friendly golden retrievers with signs that say "pet me" on it, and that's like everyone wins there.
That.
So it's like I'm fine with tuition going towards that.
Me too.
Yeah, but that's,
so
that's
how's
I mean,
that how's that any different than someone just wants
I love
to
dogs.
cuddle with a bear because they
but that's
can't
what I mean.
Handle
like,
scary
like,
thoughts.
Give
like,
me a jar of peanut butter and a spoon and a dog friend.
No, you
and
can't have peanut butter. Allergies.
I think
you know what this is why I'm against all this stuff.
But that's what I mean. Can a safe space like isn't like why isn't that like the definition of a safe space? Just
what does safe mean?
No, that's what I mean. Like just don't be a dick and then make that everywhere. Like isn't that?
But
like,
you know why they call it a safe space?
I have a right to be a dick.
True.
I totally have the
and
legal
I will
right.
be
like,
a dick
I, you
if
have the,
you're purposely making a power play at me to not be a dick.
But that's what I mean. If we all just don't act like dicks, there's no
sure.
reason to do it.
But
like,
it's,
you
it's,
have
it's,
the
it's
right
a,
to non-threateningly tell a cop to go fuck himself. In practice, you really don't. It depends on the officer. But theoretically, you have that right.
Yeah, but
it's, it's a good rule of thumb to not do it, but you definitely can do it.
Yeah,
and
don't
it
do
general, may or may not be good.
But how often do you go around telling people to go fuck themselves? Like, I don't do that to not cop
sometimes
people.
They deserve it, and you want to have the freedom to say it.
Okay. I mean,
so,
I don't know how often
so,
this happens.
So, Joe,
to you,
what Johnny's saying...
To your point, Luke, is how far is far enough the diminishing returns? I think that's the point of having like a good press at a free society is after a certain point, the society goes, all right, enough with this shit. I need to get to work. Like this is just getting
right.
in the way. And then
yeah,
you have the
fair.
Pushback. So right. when you say who decides it's enough, well, if you brought crime up. I'm getting you get ready, Luke. You brought crime up. You said the crime rate's dropped in the last 50 years. Well, what's caused that? One theory is economic development. Another really controversial theory is Roe v. Wade going into practice, and a
that
lot
was
of lower
from Freakonomics
people,
said that.
Yeah, it was in the Freakonomics book. I'm not making this up. Is it kind of correlates the drop in crime rate right when like all these lower income unplanned children who are more probable to become criminals would have gotten to that age of they just didn't exist. And it's like, yeah, that was unfair to those potential kids on like the pro-life side of the argument, all the non-criminals in that group that could have been people, but we got a safer society.
And the criminals, dude.
So
I mean, criminals
yeah.
still have the right to exist.
But
yeah, so you could.
Yeah, I didn't know where I was going with that.
So you could argue that it's unfair to all of them, but you know, it made our lives better. So you might think an equality like of outcome argument or forced equality is unfair to you, a white man. And sure, maybe it is in your case. You're being overlooked for something you're qualified for.
I mean, I would say it's unfair to everyone in
the
long
term. But people that look like you have already had enough of an advantage that if it's unfair to you for a little bit to reach that equality with racism or sexism or whatever, how is that any different than those aborted 80s babies?
Okay.
Huh?
I totally lost that train of thought,
I
like the passion.
Answer. So I'll just tease apart. There's two camps on the left. There's the kind of camp that I find myself in, which is that I think as humans, we organize ourselves into hierarchies of various types. Obviously, economics is a big one in terms of how rich you are, right? Wealth begets wealth.
Yeah. Well, I don't think that's... I think that's just
factually. To those who have, more will be given.
True.
To those who have not, more will be taken. That's from the Bible.
Is it really?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Matthew
it holds
something.
Up.
But we've seen that throughout history. Like,
I know.
That's true.
I'm saying that's just
no, I'm
the
agreeing with you.
Pareto.
That was true before the Bible.
Principle.
Yeah, that's just...
I think this like Italian mathematician noticed that like 80% of farmland in Italy belonged to 20% of farmers. Like, it's a general rule that like...
1%! Bernie was right!
That wealth tends to accumulate on the top.
Right.
And so you say, okay, in hierarchies, they tend to get lopsided and potentially corrupt. And so the voice of the left and the kind that the reason I find myself on the left and really am into the concept of a left in politics is that you need to watch out for hierarchies getting too lopsided where the wealth accumulates on the top. So you need to have a way of redistributing that wealth somehow, whether that's through quote unquote trickle down. You know, these are all empirical claims that you can check to see if they work. Unfortunately, we don't even hear this level of conversation in politics. Yeah. But anyways, that's the true voice of the left. Now, what Johnny was saying is that there is another
camp. That's the Pareto distribution is what you're thinking.
Yeah, yeah. That's that if you take the square root of the total number that, you know, like, so if you have 10,000 musicians, 100 will account for, you know, over half of the, you know, downloads or whatever the thing
is. Yeah, right, right. Yeah. I was just given the name.
So, okay. So the other camp of the left is more along the lines of, well, history has been so unfair that we have to turn the tables, right? And this is where you start to get more of the conversation of, well, racism is only white in the direction of white to black, not black to white. This is where you get more of the conversation of, no, 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 we should be discriminating against white people in this way or any other majority in this way because we have to repair, right? This is what the word reparations means, right? Now, even a lot of the people in the IDW are of the mindset to say, yes, there has been historical disadvantages specifically to certain groups, but generally to a lot of groups. There are intelligent ways to go about fixing them, but this is not it. So I want to make a distinction. Johnny said something that I would characterize as the new left, and where I find myself is on a more classical version of the left. So the new left is more of the camp that would say, let's have a no whites on campus today. Let's discriminate against Asians. There's a big lawsuit against Harvard because they discriminate against, allegedly, it seems pretty clear that they do, discriminate against Asian Americans.
Well, let me ask
you. So hold on, Luke. To push back against that is, yes, you might be right, but you know, that's the approach to equality they came up with when it was dominantly, you know, it was clearly unequal. In the, you know, back in the 70s when it's a mostly white country where white people had all the power, especially white males, when they decided or when society started loosening up and being like, yeah, you know, we'll get there. You just be nice to people and racism will clear itself up. So to some of those people, it might feel like now it's happening too fast by people trying to force it to speed up. But to those people, it seems so slow still because it's been going on not just for the last 50 years, but for... It's taken hundreds of years.
So to them,
another few decades is way too long. They'd rather have the forced radical change, and then we'll you know what I mean?
But so your version of the new left that you're arguing for right now is at least intellectually honest in that you're telling me what you think. But most of the conversations I hear, they are actually just creating like a smoke show of like, I'm over here, now I'm over here, now I'm over here, and... Now you must accept my conclusion. And I'm like, I don't even know what you just said to me. You structured like three run-on sentences. You talked about oppression. You sound like you're being righteous. So like the crowd watching us is like 90% leaning your way because you seem to be saying like we should do the right thing here.
Very passionately.
Very passionately. And I'm just dryly arguing for
it.
Yeah,
but that's not what I said. I just made a good point, I think.
You did make a good point. That's why I said you steel-manned it for them.
Yeah,
and that's what I love about the IDW is it will steel man its opponent's point, which it does, you know? And it does have, there is a point to be had from even the new left SJW thing, but let's be honest about what they're saying, right?
Well, that's sort of kind of the way I think about it, where like the fact that, and I think this fits into this larger idea of how it's such a polarized narrative where you're either on one side or you're not. And I think it leaves people like us sort of, just kind of left adrift because I mean I think
the middle's unexciting, right?
Well, that's the thing. I think we all recognize that there's inequality and there's issues. And this is we've talked about it before when we did the education episode. Like I worked for a year in the city in social work, and essentially my job was to help inner city minority students who didn't have, you know, they just were not raised in a culture of where education had value, where it had importance. And these were students who don't know where to go. Like they don't understand that if you take these steps,
they didn't have a life trajectory that anyone set for them.
It unlocks certain doors, and it's like there's a very valid argument there where it's like, yeah, like I've seen students where that happens, where if they're left adrift, they sort of fall into these cycles.
And can I ask were the majority of those students minorities?
Yes, and I think
would you say that the conclusion looking at that, would you say it's primarily racism that accounts for that or economics?
I think it's all tied together.
Of course, but I mean, like, what is the in other words, if it were the 1950s, I think you could more argue that the primary thing holding certain groups back was racism.
It would be
now
like
you can say it's like 10% of the cause, but the way the left speaks, the new left speaks now, you would think that it's the primary cause of.
Where'd you get 10% from, Luke?
Oh,
number pretty quick.
I threw out a number.
But what I'm saying is...
I would
is
guess
like
it's higher than that. But
I'm saying...
I mean, it might be. I just threw out a number that meaning it's not... You know, in 1950, if you wanted to be a black professor at Harvard, racism was holding you back probably like 90% of the way.
Probably
right?
A lot more, yeah.
Yeah, you couldn't even get an interview.
But
I don't think that's the case today. And nobody likes to talk about the fact that we can say, yo, it's gotten insanely better. Have we dotted every
yeah.
I
so so what I was saying
no.
is a program like that I worked in that like that was sort of the point was to continue to recognize and address those issues. And I think you're right. Obviously, like you point out with those examples, it has gotten better. And so my point is that the fact that there's not
markedly better.
Yeah, and there's not an acknowledgement of that, but also an acceptance of the fact that there's more work to continue doing. It's like I don't understand, like, cuz I hear it's just either one or the other, and I'm like, I'm working at this place trying to help people, and it happens to be that it's these people kind of stuck in these societal loops for different reasons. Part of it's racism, part of it's socioeconomics. Of course, it all ties together, but the fact is that these people need help. And
part of it's being raised in a single-parent household where the one parent's working three jobs and is barely home.
That's a huge part of it, yeah. That's absolutely a huge part of it. But the fact that I was getting paid by the government, essentially, to do that, it's like that's a social work program. I was a social worker, but I don't have as like an ideological point. Like, I don't think that's a bad thing, and I don't think that's an extreme thing to have to pay for as a society.
No, me neither.
Yeah,
and I don't think you see many people arguing against things like that.
Well, I think if they kind of generalize, you know, what it is that like, oh, I shouldn't have to pay. You know, I shouldn't have to pay taxes for this, right?
Sure, but it's like, oh, you'll pay those taxes in police force. If you raise a whole generation of people that don't learn how to be part of society.
Great point, but you don't
see
that.
So, that's even the selfish, like, non-compassionate view. It still makes sense, yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, it totally makes sense.
Which is how you have to argue to Republicans, right?
Luke, that whole thing you just... what you just said about how much insanely better it's gotten.
All right, that was the end of part one. Obviously, we just cut it out mid-conversation. So, thanks for listening all the way through. If you're liking the vibe of the conversation... part two might already be out. It'll take me a couple more days to edit. And we're just going to pick up exactly where we left off. And it's another hour or so of conversation. So thanks for listening and see you in the next episode.